Probability, Normalcy, and the Right Against Risk Imposition by Martin Smith. Many philosophers accept that, as well as having a right that others not harm us, we also have a right that others not subject us to a risk of harm. And yet, when we attempt to spell out precisely what this right against risk imposition involves, we encounter a series of notorious puzzles. Existing attempts to deal with these puzzles have tended to focus on the nature of rights. But I propose an approach that focuses instead on the nature of risk. The key move is to distinguish two different ways in which to conceptualize the risk that a given action presents, one of which is linked to the notion of probability and the other to the notion of normalcy. Section 1. The risk thesis and the high risk thesis. Consider the following case of pure risk imposition from Judith Jarvis Thompson. Suppose A plays Russian roulette on B. That is, suppose A takes a revolver, inserts a bullet into one chamber, spins the cylinder, aims at B's head, and pulls the trigger. Suppose that, as it happens, the chamber that rotates into the firing position when the trigger is pulled is empty, and the gun does not discharge. Suppose further that B is asleep or otherwise unaware of what is happening, and as a result, experiences no fear or distress. We can all agree that, other things being equal, A's action is morally impermissible. But surely B would not merely regard this as an impermissible action, an action that A ought not to have performed. No, he would see this as a violation of his rights. And A's action has many of the telltale signs of a rights infringement. A's action could never be justified on purely hedonistic grounds. That is, it could never be justified on the grounds that it would bring pleasure to A or to others, irrespective of the amount of pleasure that might be derived. Given the opportunity, B, or a third party, would have been morally permitted to use force, even extreme force, against A, in order to prevent him from undertaking the action. Finally, in the absence of a strong reason or excuse, it would be legitimate for A to be punished, perhaps even severely punished, for his conduct. But what right of B's could have been infringed by A's action? It's natural to think that we each have a right not to be harmed by others. However, by stipulation, B has not suffered any actual harm at the hands of A. That is why the risk imposition is described as pure. Perhaps the most obvious suggestion is that in addition to the right that others not harm us, we also have a right that others not subject us to a risk of harm. And this is the right that A infringes. Call this the risk thesis. Although it provides a straightforward treatment of this example, the risk thesis faces an immediate problem. Many of the ordinary activities we engage in every day will impose some risk of harm on others. If, for instance, A drops a piece of bread into his toaster and presses down the lever, there is some risk that this could cause a fire in which his neighbour B dies. But presumably, B has no right that A refrain from making toast. The risk that B would die as a result of A making toast is, of course, very low, at least in the order of 1 in billions, and this suggests an obvious fix. Perhaps our right against risk imposition only applies to risks that are relatively high or significant, like the risk imposed by Russian roulette. The idea, more precisely, is that we have a right that others not subject us to a high risk of harm, that others not act in such a way that the risk of our being harmed as a result of their action exceeds a threshold T. This is sometimes referred to as the threshold risk thesis or high risk thesis. While it may appear more promising than the original risk thesis, the high risk thesis faces at least two problems of its own. The first problem concerns what we might call cases of low risk Russian roulette. Suppose a bullet is placed in a single chamber of one out of a set of otherwise empty revolvers. Suppose A chooses a revolver at random, spins the cylinder, aims at B's head, and pulls the trigger. Now, the larger the set of revolvers, the lower the risk of harm that A imposes on B. If the set were sufficiently large, The risk could be lower than any positive threshold that we set, and could even be lower than the risk imposed by making toast. Suppose, for argument's sake, that we set the threshold at 1 in 500,000. In this case, if A chooses from, say, 100,000 revolvers when playing Russian roulette on B, his actions would not infringe the right posited by the high-risk thesis. And yet, A's action still has all the hallmarks of a rights infringement. In spite of the number of revolvers, A's behaviour could never be justified on the grounds that A or others find it enjoyable. In spite of the number of revolvers, it would be permissible to use force to prevent A's action, and legitimate for A to be punished if he has no strong reason or excuse. And I'm inclined to think that even extreme force and severe punishment could still be warranted in this case. The second problem for the high-risk thesis concerns cases of distributed risk, cases in which there is a high risk that some member of a group will be harmed, even though the risk to each individual member is low. Consider the following example due to David McCarthy. Suppose A is considering two options for disposing of a large quantity of a toxic chemical. First, he could surreptitiously dump the chemical into a pond that he shares with his neighbour B. Second, he could surreptitiously dump the chemical into the river that flows through his property, even though there are a million people who live downstream. The former option involves a high risk, say a 1 in 1,000 chance, that B will be exposed to a harmful quantity of the chemical. The latter option involves a very high risk that at least one of the people living downstream will be exposed to a harmful quantity of the chemical, even though the risk to each individual person is low, say a 1 in 1,000,000 chance. If a 1 in 1,000 chance is above the threshold, then, according to the high-risk thesis, B's rights would be infringed if A dumped the chemical in the pond. If a 1 in 1,000,000 chance is below the threshold, then, as far as the high-risk thesis is concerned, there is no person whose rights would be infringed if A dumped the chemical in the river. All else equal, then, dumping the chemical in the river would be the morally preferable option, as this involves no rights infringements. But this prediction seems incorrect. After all, dumping the chemical in the river involves a much higher overall risk of harm. If there are a million people living downstream who are each subjected to a 1 in 1,000,000 risk of harm, then, assuming these risks are independent, the risk of at least one person being harmed works out to approximately 64%. The high-risk thesis appears, then, to create a dubious moral preference for cases in which risk is distributed among a group of individuals, like the river option, over cases in which risk is imposed upon a single individual, like the pond option. Section 2. Revisiting the risk thesis. In response to these problems, McCarthy abandons the high-risk thesis and advocates a return to the original risk thesis, on which any risk imposition, no matter how slight, constitutes a rights infringement. As McCarthy observes, the risk thesis offers a more satisfactory treatment of the toxic chemical case. The risk thesis predicts that dumping the chemical in the river would involve a million rights infringements, while dumping it in the pond would involve only one, leading to an immediate reversal of the above verdict. All else equal, it is now the river option that would be reckoned to be morally worse. More generally, the risk thesis predicts that a risk imposition cannot be made more morally acceptable by distributing the risk among a number of individuals. On the contrary, this will simply introduce further rights infringements. The risk thesis still faces a basic problem, of course. As discussed earlier, it predicts that many of our day-to-day actions will infringe others' rights. According to McCarthy, though, this result is only problematic if it leads to the conclusion that many of our day-to-day actions are morally impermissible. We can infer the latter from the former if we assume that rights are absolute and can never be permissibly infringed. But according to McCarthy, this view is untenable. Suppose I suddenly fall ill and you possess a large quantity of a drug that I need to save my life. While I have the opportunity to take the required amount from your stockpile, The situation is so urgent that I do not have time to seek your permission or to procure the drug elsewhere. If I take the drug, then I infringe your rights and do so knowingly. After all, I know that the drugs belong to you and you have a right that others not take them without your permission. Nevertheless, if this is the only way in which I can save my life, it seems that my action is morally permitted. In McCarthy's view, an action that infringes the rights of another will be morally permissible if the reasons in favour of performing the action sufficiently outweigh the burden to the bearer of the right. So even if many of our day-to-day actions infringe the rights of others, as the risk thesis implies, these actions may yet be permissible, provided they are backed by sufficiently strong reasons. But are they backed by sufficiently strong reasons? Think again of the toast example. By making toast, A imposes a low risk of injury or death upon his neighbours, and, according to the risk thesis, he thereby infringes their rights. And yet, the reasons in favour of making toast are, by and large, pretty trivial. So in this case, if we're to have the desired result that the activity is morally permissible, then these rights infringements would have to be more trivial still. But there is something jarring about the idea that another person's rights could count for so little. This has been referred to by Fei Song and others as the cheapening of rights problem. One could perfectly well reject absolutism about rights, perhaps on the strength of examples like McCarthy's drug case, and still insist that a rights infringement could never be made permissible by something like a desire for toast. That is, one could insist that a desire for a piece of toast, rather than a slice of bread, is not the kind of thing that could ever sufficiently outweigh the burden of having a right infringed. Here is another way to put the worry. While absolutism about rights will take us from the premise that many of our day-to-day actions infringe the rights of others to the conclusion that many of our day-to-day actions are morally impermissible, it is not the only way to bridge this gap. One supposition I've been taking for granted so far is that an act that infringes another person's rights can never be justified solely on the grounds that it will bring pleasure to oneself or to others. This is clearly much weaker than absolutism about rights, and is perfectly consistent with McCarthy's preferred verdict about the drugs case, but it is inconsistent with the idea that many of our day-to-day actions permissibly infringe others' rights. Because many of our day-to-day actions, like making toast, have no discernible benefit other than to bring some small pleasure. In any case, I will not pursue this worry further here, for McCarthy's defence of the risk thesis faces another, perhaps even more serious, objection. Section 3. The role of intentions. Although the risk thesis appears to give the correct verdict in the toxic chemical case, the low-risk Russian roulette case continues to pose a problem, though somewhat subtler than the problem it poses for the high-risk thesis. If A plays low-risk Russian roulette on B, then the risk thesis, unlike the high-risk thesis, will straightforwardly predict that A infringes B's rights. However, given that A also infringes B's rights when he makes toast, we are still in need of some explanation of the blatant moral difference between the two actions. As mentioned above, even if the only benefit of making toast is to bring some small pleasure to A, the action is clearly permissible. But it is clearly impermissible for A to play low-risk Russian roulette on B, no matter the pleasure he might derive by doing so. As discussed, it would be permissible for one to use force to prevent A from playing low-risk Russian roulette on B, and, absent a strong reason or excuse, legitimate for A to be punished for such an action. Obviously, one cannot legitimately punish A for making toast, or permissibly use force to prevent him from doing so. Picking up on a suggestion from Thompson, McCarthy proposes that the moral difference between these two actions lies in A's intentions. To play Russian roulette on an innocent person is to intend to impose a risk of death. This seems to be the very point of the action. In contrast, imposing a risk of death is not the point of making toast. While one may be aware of this risk, It is not intended. So the reason it is impermissible for A to play low-risk Russian roulette on B, according to McCarthy, is that this action involves an intentional imposition of risk, and thus intentionally infringes B's rights. In contrast, when A makes toast, although B's rights may be infringed, the infringement is not intended, but merely foreseen. On closer inspection, though, this suggestion comes nowhere close to capturing the moral difference between these two actions. Suppose A's toaster is broken, and a third party offers to make him a slice of toast if only he plays low-risk Russian roulette on B. In this example, A has no particular wish to impose a risk of death on B. His only aim is to procure toast. Nevertheless, if A agrees to this, then his actions are hardly better than if he played low-risk Russian roulette on B with the express aim of imposing risk. It is still the case that A could be punished for such an action, and it is still the case that B or a third party could permissibly use force to stop him. The wrongness of playing Russian roulette on an innocent person has little to do with one's intentions. A willingness to impose this risk for a trivial payoff is little better than a direct desire to impose it. As well as imagining a case in which A playing low-risk Russian roulette on B does not involve an intentional imposition of risk, we could also imagine a case in which A making toast does involve an intentional imposition of risk. Suppose A does not want toast at all and uses his toaster solely to impose some small risk of death upon his neighbour B. While A's motives are certainly criticisable and would seem to reflect poorly on his moral character, it is plausible that his action is nevertheless a permissible one. And even if we do insist that A has acted impermissibly, the action is hardly the moral equivalent of playing low-risk Russian roulette on B. If B became aware of A's reasons for putting on his toaster, he may be perturbed by A's apparent maliciousness towards him, but it would not be proportionate for him to use force in order to prevent the action. If B were to use force against A, knock him out, break his fingers, even just smash his toaster, our sympathies in this story would quickly switch from B to A. Similarly, it would seem cruel and vindictive to punish A for putting on his toaster. The overwhelming sense is that, while there is clearly something morally amiss about A's state of mind, the action itself is essentially harmless and does not warrant any strong response. So the moral difference between A playing low-risk Russian roulette on B and A making toast in the house next to B's cannot be captured in the way that McCarthy proposes. What would capture this moral difference is the verdict that the former action involves an infringement of B's rights, while the latter action does not. But this, of course, is the very prediction that neither the risk thesis nor the high-risk thesis seems able to deliver. The right posited by the risk thesis is infringed by both of these actions, while the right posited by the high-risk thesis is not infringed by either. Section 4, Revisiting the High-Risk Thesis. I will now outline a way of delivering the desired verdict. The first step is to highlight a tacit assumption that has guided the discussion so far. Return to the case of low-risk Russian roulette. A single bullet is placed into a single chamber of one out of a large set of revolvers before A chooses a revolver at random, spins the cylinder, points at B, and pulls the trigger. So far, this has been classified as a low-risk scenario on the grounds that the probability of B being killed is very small. And yet, if we were actually watching these events unfold, the thing that would surely shock us and surely move us to intervene if we could is the perceived riskiness of what A is doing. It would be natural to have something like the following thought. The bullet has to be located in some chamber, and it would be just as normal for it to be in any one chamber as any other, including the chamber that slides into alignment with the barrel of A's revolver when he pulls the trigger. If B was shot and killed, then given the nature of the setup, We would not need any special explanation as to how this could have happened. One who is struck by this thought would not be altogether reassured by learning how many revolvers there were in the initial set. The more revolvers there are, the more places the bullet could end up. But there is still nothing preventing it from being in the one chamber that would result in B's death. Here is another way to put this point. The most normal possible worlds in which A plays Russian roulette on B will include worlds in which the bullet is in each of the available chambers. As a result, some of the most normal possible worlds in which A plays Russian roulette on B will be worlds in which B is killed. This represents one normal outcome of the action. Now, clearly, the notion of normalcy that is being invoked here is distinct from the idea of statistical frequency. After all, B's death is not an outcome that would frequently arise from this action, were it repeated over and over. Rather, this outcome is normal in the same sense that it would be normal for, say, 10, 7, 13, 8, 25, and 19 to be the winning lottery numbers. Some sequence of numbers has to come up, and this sequence would require no more explanation than any other. When it comes to A putting on his toaster, however, the situation seems altogether different. While it is possible that this action could cause a fire that leads to the death of his neighbour B, there is no sense in which this would count as a normal outcome of the action. On the contrary, there would have to be some explanation as to how the fire started. Was there an electrical fault in the toaster or in the wiring of A's house? How the fire took hold? Was there inflammable material around the toaster? Was there a gas leak? How A failed to extinguish the fire or raise the alarm? Was he asleep? Did he leave the house? And so on. If we were told that B had died in a fire as a result of A putting on his toaster, our immediate reaction would be to ask how this could possibly have happened. If we were told that B had died as a result of A subjecting him to Russian roulette, our reaction would be very different, no matter how many revolvers A was choosing from. I think that this contrast in our reactions is tracking a genuine difference between these two hypothetical events. Of all the outcomes that could result from A putting on his toaster, B's death is a highly abnormal one. In possible worlds talk, the most normal worlds in which A puts on his toaster are worlds in which B suffers no harm as a result, and any worlds in which this action leads to B's death are highly abnormal. It has been taken for granted in the discussion so far that the risk of a given outcome is determined by its probability. So the greater the probability, the greater the risk, and the lower the probability, the lower the risk. It has also been assumed, accordingly, that any risk threshold we use in spelling out the high-risk thesis must take the form of a probability value, such as 1 in 500,000. This probabilistic conception of risk is entrenched across a range of areas and has been largely assumed, unquestioned, in discussions of the right against risk imposition. But this conception of risk is not inevitable and should be seen as another potential moving part in the puzzles that we have been considering. The dominance of the probabilistic account of risk has recently been challenged by several authors who have put forward alternatives, such as the modal account, defended by Duncan Pritchard, the relevant alternatives account, defended by Georgie Gardner, and the normic account, defended by Ebert, Smith, and Durbach. It's the normic account that will be my focus here. According to the probabilistic account, the risk that a particular outcome would result from a given action depends on how probable it is that the outcome would result from the action. According to the normic account, the risk that a particular outcome would result from a given action depends on how abnormal it would be for the outcome to result from the action. Suppose, as hinted earlier, that possible worlds can be ranked according to their normalcy. The most normal worlds are assigned a rank of 0, the next most normal worlds are assigned a rank of 1, and so on. Suppose an action could, in principle, result in harm to a given individual. If the most normal worlds in which the action is performed include worlds in which the individual is harmed, then this outcome will have an abnormality of zero, given the action. It will, in short, represent one of the most normal outcomes of the action. If the individual does not come to harm in any of the most normal worlds in which the action is performed, then this will not be a normal outcome of the action, and its abnormality may be gauged by the difference in rank between the most normal worlds in which harm results from the action and the most normal worlds in which the action is performed. If the former worlds are one rank more abnormal than the latter, then the abnormality of the individual suffering harm, given the action, will be equal to one. If the former worlds are seven ranks more abnormal than the latter, then the abnormality of the individual suffering harm, given the action, will be equal to seven, and so on. Among the most normal worlds in which A plays Russian roulette on B are worlds in which B is shot and killed. On the normic account of risk, when A plays Russian roulette on B, the risk to B is maximal, as B's death has an abnormality of zero, given A's action. So while I have spoken of cases of low-risk Russian roulette, and will for ease continue to use that term, on a normic interpretation, there is, in effect, no such thing as low-risk Russian roulette. The normic risk is maximal, no matter how many revolvers are involved. In contrast, when A makes toast, this will count as a low-risk activity in both the probabilistic and normic senses. While there are possible worlds in which A's putting on his toaster results in a fire in which B dies, these worlds are highly abnormal. Now, it is important to emphasize that I'm not proposing the normic account of risk as a competitor to the probabilistic account. In my view, both probabilistic risk and normic risk represent legitimate ways of precisifying our ordinary risk concept, as suggested by Ebert, Smith, and Durbach. In fact, this kind of pluralist approach fits well with the example of low-risk Russian roulette, in which our intuitions about the risks involved do, arguably, pull in different directions. On the one hand, it's intuitive that the risk to B diminishes as the number of revolvers is increased, that the risk is halved if two revolvers are used instead of one, and halved again if four revolvers are used, etc. This is why low-risk Russian roulette may be morally preferable to standard Russian roulette. On the other hand, it is intuitive that irrespective of the number of revolvers involved, the risk to B is greater than that imposed by A making toast or engaging in other everyday activities. This is why low-risk Russian roulette will never be the moral equivalent of an everyday activity. While the former intuition is captured by the probabilistic account, the latter intuition is captured by the normic account. For the original risk thesis, it makes no difference whether the risk in question is interpreted probabilistically or normically. If an action involves some probabilistic risk of harm, then there must be a possible world in which harm results from the action, in which case the action will also involve some normic risk of harm, and vice versa. When it comes to the high-risk thesis, however, the two different ways of disambiguating the notion of risk give rise to two distinct theses. The probabilistic high-risk thesis, which we've been taking for granted so far, and the normic high-risk thesis. According to the probabilistic high-risk thesis, we have a right that others not subject us to a high probabilistic risk of harm. More precisely, we have a right that others not act in such a way that the probability of our being harmed as a result of their action is above a threshold T. According to the normic high-risk thesis, we have a right that others not subject us to a high normic risk of harm. More precisely, we have a right that others not act in such a way that the abnormality of our being harmed as a result of their action is below a threshold T. Unlike the risk thesis and the probabilistic high-risk thesis, the normic high-risk thesis can separate the act of playing low-risk Russian roulette on an innocent from the act of making toast. While the right posited by the risk thesis is infringed by both acts, and the right posited by the probabilistic high-risk thesis is infringed by neither, the right posited by the normic high-risk thesis given an appropriate choice of threshold, will be infringed by the first act, but not the second. Having distinguished between probabilistic and normic risk, one might wonder why it is the second kind of risk that should figure in our right against risk imposition. Why should we have a right that others not subject us to a high normic risk of harm? On first impressions, this claim might seem rather mysterious. My primary aim here is to argue that by understanding the right against risk imposition in normic terms, we are able to solve a number of problems that arise for rights-based approaches to the ethics of risk imposition. Questions about the foundation or basis of such a right lie for the most part beyond the scope of this paper. But I will conclude this section with one speculative line of thought based on a connection between normic risk and the limits of our responsibility for the consequences of our actions. Suppose A's decision to make toast really did lead to a fire in which his neighbour B died. In this case, it is plausible that this outcome would not be wholly attributable to A's action, for it would owe in part to circumstances, be they faulty wiring, a gas leak, etc., that lie completely outside of A's awareness and control. As a result, A would not be considered fully responsible for B's death. Similar remarks apply to any action that presents a low normic risk of harm. If there is a low normic risk that an action will cause harm to an individual, then harm could only result through the intervention of independent interfering factors, which would serve to mitigate the agent's responsibility. There is no equivalent connection, however, between responsibility and probabilistic risk. Even if an action presents a low probabilistic risk of harm, one may still bear full responsibility for any harm that ensues. If A plays low-risk Russian roulette on B, then, irrespective of the number of revolvers involved, A would be fully responsible in the event that B was shot and killed. Now, these brief remarks do not, of course, amount to a full explanation of why the normic high-risk thesis should be true, but they do perhaps dispel some of the mystery which might otherwise surround it. One other point to bear in mind is that the probabilistic and normic high-risk theses are not formally inconsistent. While I have been assuming, as seems standard in the literature, that there is at most one right against risk imposition, there is no logical barrier to accepting both theses. And the normic high-risk thesis would surely seem less mysterious if the probabilistic high-risk thesis were accepted alongside it. In this case, any imposition of high risk would infringe a person's rights, no matter how the notion of risk is interpreted. Section 5, Distributed Risk. In Section 1, I presented two problems for the high-risk thesis, one of which concerned cases of low-risk Russian roulette, and the other of which concerned cases of distributed risk. In the previous section, I argued that, on a normic interpretation, there is no such thing as a case of low-risk Russian roulette, and the problem dissolves. In this section, I will argue that the same is true for cases of distributed risk. On a normic interpretation, such cases simply cannot arise. A case of distributed risk, recall, was defined as one in which there is a high risk that some member of a group will be harmed, even though the risk to each individual member is low. Consider a group of individuals, C, D, E, F, etc., and suppose there is a high risk that some member of the group will suffer harm. On the normic account, this means that there is a relatively normal possible world in which some member of the group suffers harm. But any world in which some member of the group suffers harm must either be a world in which C suffers harm, or a world in which D suffers harm, and so on, in which case either C must be at a high risk of harm, or D must be at a high risk of harm, and so on. That is, if there is a high normic risk that some member of the group will be harmed, then there must be some member of the group who is at a high normic risk of harm. If the risk to each member is equal, then they will all face a high normic risk of harm. The normic account, in effect, predicts that these two risk attributions are equivalent. It makes no difference whether the high risk operator or the existential quantifier is given wide scope. So what, then, will the normic high-risk thesis predict in putative cases of distributed risk, such as the toxic chemical case? In the toxic chemical case, we are explicitly told the probabilistic risks associated with each possible action. We're told that if A dumps the chemical in the pond, then there is a 1 in 1,000 chance that B will be exposed to a harmful amount. And if A dumps the chemical in the river, then for each of the million people living downstream, there is a 1 in a million chance that the individual will be exposed to a harmful amount. Obviously, there are no normic risks stipulated, and the details that would be needed to assess these risks are also largely missing in existing descriptions of the case. Here, perhaps, is one natural way of filling in the required details. If A were to dump the chemical in the pond, then, given the quantity and potency of the chemical, the volume of the pond, and the way in which B normally uses the pond water, the amount of chemical to which B is exposed will vary throughout a certain range. While most of the values in this range would result in no ill effects, the highest values would cause harm to B. In this case, if B were to suffer harm as a result of A dumping the chemical in the pond, then no special explanation would be needed. This would be like subjecting B to a kind of low-risk, or perhaps medium-risk, Russian roulette. Similarly, if A were to dump the chemical in the river, then each individual living downstream faces a potential exposure range, given facts about the quantity and potency of the chemical, the volume and flow of the river, and the way in which the river water is normally used. If some of the values in this range are above the harmful level, then once again, for a given individual to suffer harm as a result of A dumping the chemical in the river would not demand special explanation. This would be like subjecting each of these individuals to a kind of low-risk Russian roulette. When the details are filled in like this, all of the normic risks are maximal. If A dumps the chemical in the pond, then B is at maximal normic risk of harm. And if A dumps the chemical in the river, then every individual downstream is at maximal normic risk of harm. As a result, the normic high-risk thesis will predict that, all else equal, it would be morally worse to dump the chemical in the river, as this would involve a million rights infringements, while dumping the chemical in the pond would involve only one. If, however, we were to alter the case in such a way that the presence of the chemical in the river would present only a low normic risk to each of the people living downstream, then the normic high-risk thesis could make a different prediction. What might such a case look like? Well, suppose a series of measures is in place to prevent the people living downstream from ever coming into contact with the river water. Perhaps the land around the river is private and trespassers face penalties or prosecution. Perhaps the river is protected by a high fence, etc. None of this would make it certain that a given person living downstream will not be harmed if the chemical is dumped in the river, but it would generate the need for special explanation in the event that they are harmed. How did they get past the fence? Why were they willing to trespass? And so on. If the details are filled in this way, then for any individual X living downstream, it would be abnormal for X to be harmed as a result of A dumping the chemical in the river. If the degree of abnormality is greater than the threshold posited by the normic high-risk thesis, then as far as the thesis is concerned, dumping the chemical in the river will involve no rights infringements. If the situation with B and the pond is unchanged from the description given earlier, then all else equal, the normic high-risk thesis will predict that it is morally preferable for A to dump the chemical in the river. As we've seen, though, since the normic risk to each individual living downstream is low, so too is the normic risk to the group. Dumping the chemical in the river presents a low normic risk of any individual being harmed. Not only, then, does dumping the chemical in the pond infringe B's rights, It also involves a higher overall normic risk of harm. If A were to dump the chemical in the pond, then B could suffer harm in a way that is consistent with conditions being normal. This would represent one of the normal outcomes of the action. If A were to dump the chemical in the river, then under normal conditions, there is no individual who would be harmed. Furthermore, if an individual living downstream were harmed as a result of A dumping the chemical in the river, then A would not be fully responsible for this harm, as it would be due in part to the individual's own actions, trespassing, scaling the fence, etc. Now, it might still be the case, of course, that dumping the chemical in the river would involve a higher overall probabilistic risk of harm. Indeed, there is no reason why the probabilities could not remain as originally stipulated. Given the sheer number of people who live downstream, if A dumps the chemical in the river, then there is a 64% chance that at least one of these people will, for some reason, flout the rules, come into contact with the water, and be harmed. In light of this, some would balk at the idea that facts about normic risk could ever make the river option morally preferable to the pond option. Some would insist that, with the probabilities as they are, the river option would always be morally worse. I will not attempt to engage this position here, except to say this. The prediction that the river option may be morally worse, depending on how the non-probabilistic details of the case are filled in, is as close as we can come to the above prediction while working exclusively within the framework of individual rights. The only right against risk imposition that will yield the result that the river option is always morally worse than the pond option is the right posited by the original risk thesis. And, as argued, this thesis is untenable. Those who wish to maintain that the river option is always morally worse should, I suggest, give up on attempting to derive this result purely from a right against risk imposition. One could still accept the existence of such a right and still perhaps find explanatory work for it, but would need to argue that, when it comes to comparing these two options, rights infringements are not the decisive factor. Section 6. Conclusion. I have argued that the most promising rights-based approach to the ethics of risk imposition comes in the form of the normic high-risk thesis, the claim that we each have a right that others not impose a high normic risk of harm upon us. Unlike the risk thesis, the normic high-risk thesis does not make for rampant, trivial rights infringements. Unlike the probabilistic high-risk thesis, the normic high-risk thesis does not generate a moral preference for cases in which a risk is distributed among the members of a group. Unlike either of these theses, the normic high-risk thesis is able to account for the moral difference between the risks imposed by making toast and the risks imposed by low-risk Russian roulette.